Here's a quote which seems urgently contemporary. It goes like this. There is a widespread belief that existing unemployment is the result in large part of the gross inequality in the distribution of wealth and income, which giant corporations have fostered, that by the control of which the few have exerted through giant corporations, individual initiative and effort are being paralyzed. Well, it wasn't written in 2016. It was written in 1933 by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, a man whom constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen calls the most prescient judicial philosopher of the 20th century. Rosen's written a new book about Brandeis. It's called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. And I spoke with Jeffrey Rosen recently, just shy of the 100th anniversary of Brandeis's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court.
June 1st, 1916, he was confirmed. He was nominated on January 28th, so he waited 125 days between nomination and confirmation. That's the longest wait any nominee has had so far. If Merrick Garland still doesn't have a hearing by July 19th, if I counted right, then Garland will surpass that record.
Okay, so what was it that took Brandeis's confirmation hearing? What made it so long? Was he controversial at the time?
He sure was.
And part of the controversy.
Yes, exactly. It's funny you should ask that question. He was remarkably controversial for a number of reasons. Most importantly, because of the crusading anti-corporate populism that you quoted from in that incredibly eloquent Ligon Lee opinion on the Supreme Court. He's known as the people's attorney in Boston. He makes his name with his attacks on the Boston Consolidated Gas Company. Doesn't that sound menacing? And the New Haven Railroad. And essentially, he's insisting that the greedy banks are taking reckless risks with other people's money. That's the immortal, memorable phrase of his 1913 book. So this gets a lot of opposition, especially in Boston. It's great to talk about him here. And there was this remarkable chart that used to hang in the offices of the New Republic, where I worked for a long time, that showed the arrayed Boston interests that were opposing his confirmations, led by President Abbott Lawrence Lowell of Harvard, whose anti-Semitic policies that excluded Jews. Mm-hmm. So Lowell was not a fan of Brandeis for his religion as well. And then State Street bankers and other interests. And finally, it goes up to the editor of the New Republic, but his son-in-law works for J.P. Morgan, the oligarch who Brandeis is always attacking. So they kill the chart, and it hung in the New Republic office.
Well, so just to be clear, I mean, this is a chart that Brandeis or someone from his law firm sent to the New Republic to literally show the interconnectedness of power and financial interests in Boston who had allied against him and opposed his confirmation to the Supreme Court.
Precisely. It's done by the New Republic editors in conversation with Brandeis' supporters.
Yeah. Well, the book is so fascinating because there's even, you have something that President William Howard Taft had written about Brandeis at the time. And I mean, I just have to read a little bit of it to show how passionately opposed some of the most powerful people in America were to putting Brandeis on the court. Taft had said that he is a muckraker, an emotionalist for his own purposes, a socialist prompted by jealousy, a hypocrite, a man who has certain high ideals in his imagination but who is utterly unscrupulous in method in reaching them, a man of infinite cunning, of great tenacity of purpose, and in my judgment, of much power for evil.
Yes. Remarkable, isn't that? And this is, you know, the president of the United States. Taft, of course, has a grudge because Brandeis has embarrassed him in a congressional hearing where there was an environmental scandal, and Brandeis basically proves that Taft had lied about backdating a certain document. It's the Watergate hearings of its day. The cover-up is worse than the crime. Also, Taft is yearning to be on the Supreme Court himself and just poignantly hopes that Woodrow Wilson is going to appoint him to the court, even though Wilson had just defeated him. So there was a personal grudge. Remarkably, Taft is appointed Chief Justice a few years later, fulfilling his lifelong dream, and he and Brandeis make up, and they both care so passionately about the institutional legitimacy of the court that Brandeis joins all sorts of opinions, and Taft burbles happily, you know, all goes very well in the conference room. So they did bury the hatchet.
So on June 1st, 1916, Louis Brandeis gets confirmed, and he joins the U.S. Supreme Court, and you write how his judicial philosophy can roughly be described as resting on three pillars: a commitment to judicial restraint, which we'll talk about in a moment, that crusading opposition to big corporations in America and their potential effect on democracy, and the idea that the Constitution is a living document that can use the totality of American history to that point in order to assess or take a look at important issues coming before the court. So those are the three pillars here. I just wanted to put that out there because I wanted to step back actually in time a little bit and ask you, where did Brandeis's judicial philosophy come from? What were the major influences on his life?
The major influence, I end up concluding, was Thomas Jefferson. And I make the claim that he was the greatest critic of bigness in both business and government since Thomas Jefferson. He was the Jewish Jefferson in the sense. And he came to that sort of later in life. It was not until the 1920s that he started reading deeply in Jefferson and quoting him in his inaugural address and his letters. And like Jefferson, Brandeis views American history as a clash between oligarchic financiers and producers and agrarian farmers. And he thinks that constitutionally, you have to protect the interests of producers against the financiers, and that just influences his whole vision of political economy and ultimately his judicial philosophy. He did care about judicial restraint in the sense of deferring to state laboratories of democracy and experimentation, but ultimately he was a constitutional visionary who was enacting from the bench the very views that he had championed as an advocate. And in that sense, that made him incredibly influential, but it sort of transcended his commitment to judicial deference.
I mean, when you read the kinds of things that he wrote even prior to him joining the Supreme Court, they sound like they could have been written today. I mean, things like the American people have as little need of oligarchy in business as in politics. He railed against investment bankers after the turn of the century, even beforehand, saying that they take the golden eggs laid by somebody else's goose. And of course, for example, tell us about what his view was of people like J.P. Morgan, who, as you write, in 1911 controlled roughly 40% of the capital raised in America.
It's remarkable. I love the fact that you're reading from those excerpts. And it's really The Big Short of its day. Brandeis is making the exact same critique. And in the sense he predicted the crash of 29, he says that J.P. Morgan is taking reckless risks with what he unforgettably calls other people's money because he's leading people to invest in financial instruments are so complicated that no one can possibly understand their value. Sound familiar? It's like credit default swaps. And Brandeis is criticizing the complexity of Morgan's oligarchic operations that ensure that he assumes none of the risks but gets all of the benefits, and when there's a crash, he can just run. It's a precursor of too big to fail. So his economic critique is connected to his theory of knowledge, which is that no person can master the facts that are necessary to understand an institution unless it's on a pretty small scale. And that was why he liked the states and why he liked small business and why he ultimately came to see in Israel and the kibbutzim the apotheosis of his Jeffersonian dream of a place where citizens could really govern themselves on a small scale.
In 1926, apparently, Brandeis observed, you quote him as saying that, "I wish to record my utter inability to understand why a lot of folks don't go broke." And he predicted a financial breakdown within a year. He was just off by a couple of years.
Completely. And he's telling his brother that the stock market is a kind of legalized gambling. Brandeis always invests in completely conservative bonds. And through this conservative investing and very simple living, he becomes a millionaire when he's young and dies with $3 million, an amazing amount that sort of surprised his progressive acolytes. But it's just because of his he believed that he had to get this surplus to earn freedom. He said, "What I care about is freedom, and I want to invest my free time on behalf of the public interest." Mm.
Now, I was very taken by what you said a little earlier, that you call Brandeis the Jewish Jefferson. You give an example of how that actually played out in policies that he was able to enact. You say one of his great achievements as a reformer was in savings bank insurance in Massachusetts.
Yes, he's very keen on irregularity of employment. He thinks it's unfair that employers hire people for a little bit and then lay them off, and also that they have nowhere to save their money except in these usurious and risky instruments. So he doesn't like federal level unemployment insurance like Social Security, but he thinks a state level savings bank insurance that has sound banks that ensure a steady return will allow people to weigh out the waves of unemployment. And he considers that the perfect reform. And savings bank insurance celebrated its 100th anniversary here in Massachusetts not long ago. So it's just a great example for him of a local reform that helped small business people and workers.
Why do you think there aren't more sort of followers of Brandeisism, if I can call it, today?
I think because he, on the one hand, is a libertarian and civil libertarian icon, and both the left and the right can converge around his opposition to monopoly power and to NSA surveillance, for example. But progressives have lost some of the Jeffersonian tradition, and Tea Party conservatives have lost the anti-corporate tradition. I'm hoping with this book to play a small role in galvanizing a pro-Brandeis movement to sweep the nation and remind both sides, liberals, libertarians, and conservatives, that this is a justice for all the people.
Jeffrey Rosen is author of Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet.